This is the In Focus podcast from The Hindu.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the In Focus podcast. I'm your host, G. Sampath. It was widely expected that Iran would respond to the bombing of its consulate in Syria in what was a suspected Israeli strike. And it was an attack that killed 7 senior military and diplomatic officials of Iran. And the retaliation came last Saturday when Iran launched a direct attack on Israel. Israel claims to have intercepted 99% of the 300 odd drones and missiles fired by Iran, but a few of the missiles did sneak through its defenses and hit sensitive military targets on Israeli territory. Now, Iran has said that it would take no further action unless Israel chooses to escalate. Israel, on its part, has vowed to, quote-unquote, exact the price from Iran when the time is right. What are the strategic implications of Iran's unprecedented direct strikes on Israel? How serious are the risks of a wider regional war? And where does this leave the ongoing negotiations for a ceasefire in Gaza? We discuss all these questions and more in this episode of In Focus, and we are joined by Stanley Johnny, who has just returned from a visit to Israel. Stanley, welcome back to In Focus.
Thanks, Sambath. Glad to be back.
So, Stanley, both Iran and Israel have claimed military success following Iran's strike with a barrage of missiles and drones on Israeli territory. Some 300 of them is what the number we are hearing. And Israel claims to have intercepted nearly all of them, proving its defensive capabilities. And Iran claims to have hit military targets and sort of, you know, proclaimed its deterrence capabilities. So who has come out looking stronger from this whole exchange in your assessment?
I think both make sense when they claim that, when the Iranians say that they hit Israeli target and the Israelis say that they intercepted most of the Iranian projectiles. Both of them make sense. I'll explain how. See, when the Iranian embassy complex was attacked on April 1st by the Israelis, it is now an open secret that Israel carried out the attack. Israelis have never denied that, that their role in the attack. It was evident that Iran would do something. But I don't think that not many expected that Iran would launch such a massive attack from its soil directly targeting Israel proper. That was something analysts did not expect. Everybody expected Iran to use the proxies. That's not what happened. So Iran launched, and this is not a small attack. Iran launched some 300 drones, attack drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles. In total, 300 plus. And some of them actually hit military targets in Israel. And on the other side, Israel faced such a massive attack, and Israel claims that they shot down 99% of the barrage. But Israel was supported by the United States, by the French, by the British, and by the Jordanians. So Israel has one of the world's most layered missile defense systems. And this was added and further bolstered, strengthened by Israel's allies, basically the alliance that put together by the United States. And everybody was in action, right? The Jordanians shot down the drones and missiles in the Jordanian airspace. The Israelis and the Americans were shooting down projectiles in the Syrian airspace. So most of the drones did not even make it into the Israeli airspace. So collectively, they shot down the Iranian projectiles. So, which actually shows that Israel's defense capabilities, when it is supported by Israel's allies, is quite strong. But on the other side, despite this, you have one of the world's most advanced defense systems, and you have some of the most powerful countries supporting Israel's defense systems, including the United States, France, and the United Kingdom, and still Iran, a country that has been living under sanctions for decades. A country that is nearly isolated in West Asia, which is living in hostility with the United States and other big powers in the region, And that country managed to penetrate into this layered defense system and hit military targets. So this is, I think, both make sense in a sense. This shows both Israel's defense capabilities, and it also shows Iran's very effective offense capabilities.
Right. I mean, I have a corollary question on this, Stanley. See, did Iran really launch 300 missiles expecting 290 of them to be intercepted? Like, what is the point of launching so many missiles when you don't even expect them to make it? I mean, I'm trying to understand, like, Iran's retaliatory strikes, what do they really mean in terms of its military capabilities vis-a-vis, as you rightly pointed out, an Israel that is backed by the full might of not just the US, but also the American allies, France and Jordan and everybody else in the region. So there is a point of view which would argue that Iran's deterrence, so to speak, is hollow because the strikes were, you know, just for show to appease its domestic audiences, and they didn't really do any damage in Israel. Seven of its commanders were killed, but no, there were no casualties at all on the Israeli side. So what exactly has been achieved, you know, and what do we make of a strike where out of 300, 290 were intercepted? What is the benefit of this kind of attack for the attacker? I mean,
yeah. Okay. So let's look at this appeasing the domestic audience question. That is one. Clearly, that's one of the factors because, you know, especially a revolutionary regime, and even if you look at the Israeli government, everybody comes under domestic pressure and they will have to act. So this is one of the factors, but is this the only factor? That's the question. Let's look at your question from a different point of view. See, what did Iran achieve from this? They launched some 170 attack drones and Rostov cruise missiles and ballistic missiles, right? And they launched it after days, and they launched it after US and other intelligence reports were leaked into the press saying that Iran was going to do exactly the same, up to 300 to 400 drones and missiles. And these drones that took hours to reach, the slow-moving drones, hours to reach Israeli airspace, that also gave enough time and preparations for the Israelis and their allies to shoot them down. The Iranians knew this, right? So still, the question is, why did they do this? So, you know, there are different answers to this. One could be by launching 170 attack drones, Iran wanted to overwhelm the defense systems of these countries in the region. So Iran's actual goal is to hit Israel with its ballistic missiles. So, but Iran knew that Israel has, as I said earlier, one of the most advanced missile defense systems. So it wanted to test the missile defense systems. It wanted to overwhelm the missile defense systems so that its ballistic missiles would hit the target it wanted to hit, right? And then secondly, despite this multi-layered defense system, Israeli ballistic missiles actually hit Israel. Iran's ballistic missiles actually hit Israel proper. And the Iranians wanted to hit the missile, wanted to hit the airbase. They did not want to hit civilian infrastructure or critical infrastructure. But the message the Iranians are trying to send to the Israelis and the Americans is that despite your missile defense systems, despite the support Israel is enjoying from the United States, from the United Kingdom, from Jordan, and from France, and maybe from other countries, apparently there were reports that the Saudis and the Emiratis had shared intelligence with the Israelis. They did not actively participate in interception, but they shared intelligence. So the American alliance kind of stays intact in the region. So despite the mighty alliance, the presence of the mighty alliance, the Iranians actually carried out precision strike at an Israeli air base. So which also means that in the event of an all-out war, if the Iranians wanted to attack critical infrastructure in Israel, they could carry that out. So this is basically, in plain and simple, Iran just showed their capability. They demonstrated their capability that they could do this. So the domestic angle is there, but that's not the whole. And I saw that many people arguing that this is just a symbolic attack. I don't think so. This is not a symbolic attack. Iran, because, you know, 300 drones, missiles, etc., etc., is not a symbolic attack. Iran basically overwhelmed the missile defense systems of all these countries and still attacked Israel proper. And if you remember, this is the first time a nation state in West Asia carrying out a missile attack on Israel since 1991, the Scud missiles launched by Saddam Hussein. And even Saddam's attack on Israel was basically a byproduct of the Kuwait war. Saddam did not want a war with Israel. Saddam was not fighting a war with Israel. Saddam was not directly challenging Israel for a war. Saddam was fighting the Kuwaitis, and the Americans were bombing. To distract the conflict, Saddam launched the Scud missiles into Iraq, into Israel. But here, the difference is that Iran is directly challenging Israel by launching a missile attack. This happened in 1973, last time, 50 years ago, when the Egyptians and the Syrians attacked Israel. So since 1973, we will say in 50 years' time, this is the first time a nation state in West Asia is directly attacking and challenging Israel. And Iran also becomes the only country in West Asia that has attacked an American and Israeli military base. Right? After Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in 2020, January, the Iranians launched a missile attack on an American base in Iraq. And after Mohammad Reza Sahedi's assassination, then the Iranians launched a missile attack on Israel. So the messages I think the Iranians are sending is very clear here.
Right. Now, speaking of the attack on the military base in Israel, Stan Levin, wasn't it the same air base from where the aircraft took off to bomb the Syrian, the consulate, Iran's consulate in Syria? I think they also made it a point to target the very same air bases which were used for the attack on the Iranian consulate.
Yeah, that's I saw some reports saying that it is the same air base that was targeted, but I don't know. We don't know, basically, because the Israelis haven't confirmed that they carried out the attack. So we only have, you know, unconfirmed reports that this is the same air base. We don't have actual confirmation.
Right, right. Now, this antagonism, this hostility between Iran and Israel has a long history, almost like half a century now. But until now, Iran has always used proxies to harass Israeli assets, to attack Israel, even, you know, the proxies like Hezbollah and the Houthis and so on. But this is the first time we have seen attacks launched from Iranian territory directly on Israel, you know. Even though this, despite being the fact that Iran still had plenty of opportunity to use proxies, you know, from Syria, from Iraq, to sort of to show that it has a power to retaliate. Now, does this signal some kind of a change in strategic thinking in Iran? What exactly is the calculus that prompted this move when it clearly, you know, could have done otherwise?
Yeah, I think this is the most interesting aspect of Iran's attack. Because, see, I was in Israel last week. Just, you know, I came back on the same day, a few hours later, Iran launched the attack. Then we were talking to Israeli diplomats there, and even Israeli academics and journalists. And most of them, despite intelligence coming from the United States that Iran would launch a direct attack, most of them were still believing that Iran would only use their proxies to attack Israel. Everybody expected Iran to respond because, you know, at the end of the day, Iran's consulate was bombed by the Israelis. And two of the IRGC commanders, including General Sahedi, and five other IRGC officers were killed in the Israeli attack, which is an act of aggression. There is no doubt about it because, you know, your embassy complex was bombed in a different country. So Iran will respond. Everybody knew that a response is coming. But I don't think that many people expected Iran to launch a direct attack on Israel. Everybody thought that Iran would use its proxies. And Iran could use its proxies, right? Hezbollah is there. And not just Hezbollah, Iran also has, Quds Force has a command center in Syria. So it was theoretically possible that if Iran wanted to launch an attack that would also give an off-ramp, Iran could have launched an attack from Syria targeting Israeli troops in Golan Heights, which is an occupied territory, you know, without directly attacking Israel proper. But I think, you know, if you look at Iran's responses over the years, Iran's response was largely muted to repeated aggressive moves by the United States and Israel. So in 2020, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was the father of Iran's nuclear program, was assassinated in the outskirts of Tehran. And this is largely attributed to the Israelis. And Israel has never denied their role in the killing of Akhrizadeh. A host of nuclear scientists were assassinated, you know, by Israel. And there were, you know, reported incidents of sabotage incidents in Iran's nuclear plants and power plants, etc., etc. And Qasem Soleimani, who was the most celebrated charismatic general in Quds Force or in IRGC, was assassinated by the Americans in 2020 January. And after October 7, the Hamas attack, you see Israel has stepped up attacking Iranian assets and proxies in the region. So on December 25th, the Christmas Day, Mohammad Reza Mousavi, Sayyid General Reza Mousavi, who was a senior IRGC advisor, was killed in Syria by the Israelis. And then on April 1st, General Mohammad Zahedi was assassinated. So I think when the consulate was bombed, when General Zahedi was killed by the Israelis, that brought in a serious change in Iran's thinking. Until then, Iran's response was basically, you know, muted. They showed strategic patience. They did not want an open confrontation, but they did things which they do secretly or using their proxies. They continue to needle the Israelis on the border. In the past, they had attacked ships in the Persian Gulf or in the Arabian Sea. And they had even attacked Israeli diplomats in different parts of the world, including in New Delhi, you know, a few years ago when Qasem Soleimani was alive and Israeli diplomat's car was bombed. So Iran had carried out attacks against Israelis using their shadow networks. But I think after General Mohammad Zahedi was assassinated, after the consulate was bombed by the Israelis, the Iranians, I think, took this critical decision that they should respond, and they should respond directly. So they wanted to change the existing equation, and they wanted to establish a new strategic equilibrium. The existing equation is that Israel would continue to attack Iranian assets, Iranian proxies, and even Iranian officers in its immediate neighborhood, which is Lebanon and Syria, even killing Iranian officers without basically, you know, facing any major response from Iran. This was the existing equation until day before yesterday, until Saturday night. But then, after carrying out a direct attack on Israel, I think the most important message the Iranians are sending is that the era of strategic patience is over. So they are telling the Israelis that if you continue to attack our officers, even if it is in Damascus or in Beirut, there will be consequences. And the consequences could be escalatory. Israel can also respond. Iran will have to face the price. But Iran, I think, has decided that they are ready to bear the price, even at the cost of an all-out war. So this is a major shift from how Iran had looked at the region till now. So the Iranians, you know, you can call them whatever you want to call, depending on your political views. But the Iranians knew that the moment they carried out a direct attack on Israel proper, which is a very rare thing in West Asia, right? You know, even after, you know, 33,000 Palestinians were killed in Gaza, Israel still has a diplomatic relationship with Egypt and Jordan. So the Arab countries hardly raise a voice against the Israelis. So Israel doesn't face any major challenge from the state actors in this region from 1973. But Iran has basically broken that consensus by directly attacking Israeli land. So the Iranians knew that they are crossing a red line. There would be repercussions. And they seem ready to face those repercussions. So I think this is a major change in Iran's approach. They want to set up a new strategic equilibrium, and they tell the Americans and the Israelis that the free hand is over. The era of strategic patience is over. I think this is my takeaway, most important takeaway from Iran's attack.
Right. I mean, the Iranians want to establish a new strategic equilibrium. Now, Stanley, this is really interesting, but do you think, what has changed? I mean, yes, Israel did attack its consulate, but something needs to have changed with Iran's own capabilities to face the repercussions you've been talking about. Otherwise, no matter, I mean, if you're facing a superior force, I mean, there's no point retaliating unless you have a chance of, you know, of sort of sustaining a kind of a hostility with that superior force. Now, Iran has been muted in its response in the past because, you know, Israel obviously has got the backing of a superpower and every other ally in the region. But now, has there been any kind of an understanding that Iran has reached? We knew that Iran, through the Swiss, had informed the U.S. that it's going to attack. And maybe did the U.S. Washington say, okay, we won't interfere, so that which emboldened Iran to make this kind of an attack? Or has Iran reached some kind of an agreement with other Arab regimes or with Russia or China? Like, what gives it the strength or the boldness or the courage to sort of to say, okay, whatever Israel can do in retaliation, we are ready for it, right? And there must be something which must have changed within Iran to be able to take that position.
Yeah, the plain answer is that we don't know what actually happened, because I think, you know, any assurance from the Americans, I don't think Iran would buy that. If you look at it from an Iranian point of view, they won't trust the Americans. You know, even the nuclear deal has gone down the tube. So that is up. So, but the Iranians may have let the Americans know, that is quite possible, let the British know that they were going to do this, through either to the Swiss or through the Omanis, that's quite possible. But the Iranians also knew that in the event of an all-out war, the United States would support Israel. I mean, everybody knows that. Even Biden is now saying that he won't join any retaliatory counterstrike. Maybe possible, but if the counterstrike leads to an all-out war between Israel and Iran, the United States would eventually be dragged into the war, which is, I mean, everybody knows that. Iranians also know that. So we don't know what actually, you know, went behind the change in their strategic calculus. But, you know, as an outsider student of West Asia, if you look at this region, you can see that a couple of things, that Israel is actually stuck in Gaza. After 6 months of war, Israel has not, we've been saying this, right? In our pieces and also in our podcast, despite the, you know, the invincibility or whatever people attribute to the IDF, after 6 months of war, Israel hasn't dismantled Hamas. Israel hasn't got the hostages back yet. And there is an internal political crisis brewing in Israel. You must have seen Yair Lapid's statement last night, where he said Israel has lost.
In the context of Yair Lapid's statement, Stanley, I was going to ask you, see, I mean, we know that Benjamin Netanyahu for the longest time has been sort of wanting the U.S. to attack Iran. I mean, he wanted some kind of a justification for a war with Iran to sort of, you know, to put an end to that threat. But now finally, he's gotten Iran to attack Israel. I mean, the Netanyahu regime got what it wanted. And now it's like, you know, now what kind of a situation?
Yeah, Netanyahu got Iran to attack Israel. That's right. But Netanyahu, the question is, whether the United States has the appetite to go for an all-out war with Iran at this point of time. See, Netanyahu always wanted to attack Iran, but Netanyahu did not want to go to a war with Iran on his own. That is the difference here we have to make. Israel doesn't want to fight Iran on its own. And it's not easy for Israel. Israel is a small country in terms of population, in terms of size. It may be a nuclear power. It is a nuclear power. But Iran, on the other side, is also a substantially powerful country. You know, you look at the size, you look at the population, you look at its history. So it won't be an easy war between Israel and Iran. And Iran has very powerful proxies. For example, Hezbollah still hasn't opened a second front, even after October 7. So, but if there is an all-out war between Israel and Iran, definitely Hezbollah is going to launch a ground attack, which means IDF will have to allocate a substantial portion of its resources to fight Hezbollah in the northern border. Because in Upper Galilee, I was there in Upper Galilee last week, Upper Galilee is already a no man's zone. Some 60,000 Israelis have been uprooted from the region because of Hezbollah rockets. So a direct war with Iran would not be easy for Israel. It would not be easy for Iran as well. But what Netanyahu always wanted to join an American-led war on Iran, not to fight Iran on his own. That is the difference here we have to make. And the United States is in an election year. Biden is facing a lot of internal challenges. And clearly, Biden has made it clear that he doesn't want a war with Iran. Right? But they also fear that they could be dragged into the war. That's a different matter. You look at Kirby's statement, you look at Blinken's statement, they all say they are basically asking Israel to stand down. Right? So I think this is a major difference here. So the Iranians look at Israel and then they see that there are issues between the Israelis and the Americans. The war in Gaza is not going on as Israel planned. And there are internal challenges which Netanyahu is facing. And they also see that the substantial anger on the Arab street towards Israel and their own governments, Arab governments, who do nothing, basically nothing to protect the Palestinian lives. So Iran sees an opportunity to directly strike Iran. This is my analysis. I may be wrong. But I'm saying, when you ask what actually made the change in Tehran, what actually prompted them to take risk, I think you have to look into all these elements into consideration.
Right. It does seem like a very complex and a bit of a bold calculation. It has its risks. But I think Iran did take a calculated gamble is what it seems like. I mean, as outsiders, we can only speculate. Now, coming to the Cairo peace talks, Stanley, when this the global attention has shifted away from the really terrible situation, which is, I mean, it's like an overstatement to call it a war. It's just a bombing and starvation campaign which is going on. And so there is this effort to come to some kind of a ceasefire. Where do we stand now? I mean, Hamas and Israel, they've been talking in Cairo. What happens to those talks? How is it going?
So I think Mossad said the other day that Hamas has rejected the Cairo proposal. So the Cairo proposal is that the Israelis wanted some 40 hostages to be released and in return for 6 to 8 weeks of ceasefire. Right? And Israel last week decided to pull back troops from southern Gaza in Khan Yunus. And that was kind of when I was in Israel, we were at the MFA, and a very senior Israeli diplomat told me that this was basically, we were trying to facilitate, talks. So Israel badly wants a hostage deal. The pressure is building up at home. Netanyahu is facing protests. Even his allies, including Benny Gantz, have called for elections. Yair Lapid has clearly asked for elections. So Netanyahu is under a lot of pressure. He wants hostages back. But he also cannot declare, a lasting ceasefire. So he's offering a temporary ceasefire. Hamas on the other side say that the withdrawal from Khan Yunus is not enough. Hamas is asking Israel to completely withdraw from Gaza Strip, which Israel is not ready to do. So basically, there is no agreement between these two. And after Israel withdrew from Khan Yunus, and after the tension between Iran and Israel is rising, I think Hamas is a bit emboldened, and Hamas is not ready to compromise at this point of time. So that's why Mossad says that Hamas has rejected the proposals. So I don't know what the next step is, because Iran's attack has entirely shifted the focus from Gaza to Israel and Iran. But as of now, what we know is that the ceasefire for hostages agreement is not taking place.
Right. So the agreement is some kind of a stalemate. The talks are in a stalemate stage. Now, one last question, Stanley, before I let you go. I mean, you were in Israel last week. So I'm just curious to know, what did you see? What did you observe it in terms of the mood, the general sentiment in the country, which is at war? We keep reading new reports that there is a lot of discontent against the Netanyahu regime, the Netanyahu administration. But has that translated, let us say, into some kind of a waning of the national appetite or the national stomach, let us say, for war and violence in Gaza? Is there any change in the mood which seems to suggest, let us say, that, okay, let's end this now. Let's call a ceasefire and then let's talk. Or is there still a huge kind of a sentiment in favor of going ahead with this current assault until, the goal, the above goal of eliminating Hamas, quote unquote, is achieved? What did you observe there?
I thought war weariness was setting in Israel. This is not because of any opposition to what Israeli army is doing in Gaza, because the people I talk to, mostly they say that they try to keep the memories of October 7 alive, and what happened on October 7 was horrific. We went to the kibbutz that was run over by Hamas, and also talked to people from south to north. But at the same time, I think there were a lot of other things that are affecting normal life in Israel. For example, the economic problems. In Jerusalem, which is one of the busiest places in terms of tourist arrival, when we were in Jerusalem, shops were getting closed by 4 p.m. Practically, there was nobody on the street, even in the old city, because they say that there are no tourists in Jerusalem. And even the Israelis are now traveling after October 7. The local economy is suffering very, very bad. And I talked to a tour guide who I met last time when I was in Israel in 2022. And she was also telling us that there is no business. There is no business at all. And also other people, for example, I talked to a taxi driver and who is saying he wants the war to be over because his son, who is a conscript, is in Gaza. He says, my boy is in Gaza, I want him back home. Because Israel is a country that has military conscription, right? So every family is affected by war. And Israeli, and also there is growing, frustration among the Israeli public with the fact that the hostages are not being released. They think the government did not do enough. So they wanted a ceasefire deal with Hamas, not for the sake of the Palestinians, but to get the hostages back. Because Hamas captured 230 people on October 7th, of which 130 people are still in captivity, and it's been 6 months. And there is a protest movement going on across Israel. So if you go to Tel Aviv airport, inside Tel Aviv airport, there is a huge banner hanging on a wall calling, bring them home, bring them back home. So in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, everywhere you will see this banner. When we were there, we were in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem saw a massive protest in front of the Knesset, Israeli parliament, in which some 50,000 people participated, and their demand, bring the hostages back. And they're asking Netanyahu to go. They're asking for elections. Benny Gantz is a member of Israel's war cabinet, and Benny Gantz has called for elections. And then we discussed Yair Lapid's statement. Yair Lapid said that Israel has lost its deterrence, and he also blamed the Jewish terrorism in the West Bank. He says the Jewish terrorism is gone out of control. So the pressure is clearly building up in Israel. War weariness is setting in because the war is going on and on without any end. And, Israel wanted to dismantle Hamas. Israel wanted to bring the hostages back. The fact of the matter is that 6 months later, the hostages are still hostages, and Hamas is far from being dismantled, while the war is on the brink of escalating into a regional confrontation with Iran and others. It's a very sad story.
Right. It is a grim situation indeed. That's very nicely summed up, Stanley. I really don't want to add to that. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your thoughts and insights. As always, pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sandar. Thank you very much.
In Focus will be back soon with analysis of the biggest news issues. In the meantime, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other platforms. Just search for In Focus by The Hindu. We'll see you soon.